Welcome to Givers, Doers, and Thinkers. Today we talk to Joshua Mitchell about how and why today's neo-Puritans think our liberation depends on the destruction of those mediating institutions which constitute civil society. Let's go. Givers, Doers, and Thinkers introduces listeners to the fascinating people and important ideas at the heart of American civil society. We speak with philanthropists, reformers, social entrepreneurs, nonprofit executives, religious leaders, scholars, journalists, and anyone else who will help us understand contemporary civil society's achievements and failures. My name is Jeremy Beer. Thank you for joining us. Okay, thank you for joining us for another episode of Givers, Doers, and Thinkers. I was told by our intrepid producer, Katie Janice, just before we started recording this episode, that we just hit the 10,000 download milestone. So that's something. I have no idea whether that's good or bad, but it's not quite Joe Rogan levels. I'm fairly certain. We're recording today on August 16th, 2022. I am in our cozy podcast studio in Phoenix, Arizona, where for about the 30th day in a row, the erosion of civil society has been amply illustrated by at least one homeless person passed out on our property when I came into the office today. So it's a good day to talk about why this is happening, not the homelessness crisis per se, but this very tangible, very obvious breakdown of civic and social order. We are blessed to be able to have that discussion with Joshua Mitchell, really a truly brilliant professor of political theory at Georgetown University, someone from whom I've learned a lot. About 17 years ago, Josh helped found Georgetown's School of Foreign Service in Doha. He also served as acting chancellor of the American University of Iraq. Out of those experiences came a book titled Tocqueville in Arabia, which will be republished in a new edition, I believe, next year. Lately, Josh has been thinking and writing about identity politics and wokeness, and the result of that reflection is a recent book titled American Awakening, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions of Our Time from Encounter Press, and I recommend it warmly and highly. Most recently, Josh published an article titled By the Sweat of Our Brow. It's in the August-September 2022 issue of First Things magazine. And that essay is going to structure much of our conversation today because it shows how the phenomenon or phenomena, however you want to look at it, of wokeness and identity politics is impacting and will continue to impact civil society, the primary theme of this podcast, of course. Josh Mitchell, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Thank you for giving us some of your time as your house on the Eastern Shore is literally being built behind you or around you. I want to just go through this article with you. And then if we have time, we can pick up on any other themes that are more fully developed in your book, American Awakening. But I found this article when I sat down to read my issue of First Things a few weeks ago, so insightful, so rich that I think we can spend a lot of time unpacking it. So basically, you begin by pointing out, I think, something very, very important, which I don't know that everyone is fully absorbed yet. I'm sure they haven't, why you wrote this, which is, you know, we're dealing with something different here. The problem today is not what Pope Benedict XVI memorably called the dictatorship of relativism. Relativism is no longer sort of the enemy or the problem or the crisis of our time. Do I have that right?
Yes, I think that is right. And I will add, I spent my undergraduate and graduate years listening to faculty members who were slightly right of center making exactly this argument. I was a student of Alan Bloom, who in The Closing of the American Mind, that famous book from the late 20th century, argued that relativism was the great threat. And one of the things I raise in the essay is that a whole generation of scholars have been caught completely off guard by the emergence of this thing that I think is best called identity politics, whose object is not relativism at all. It's a very clear moral classification system, much like you had in Puritan America, you had the saved and the damned. And because I spent a lot of time in theology departments when I was going to school, when this thing began to emerge, I don't know, we can argue about dates, it occurred to me very quickly that this is not a political movement. It's a religious movement.
Yeah. When was that? When did you realize that? Because I think it's really only started dawning on most of us, I would say, in the last few years, maybe in the last 5 years, 7 years.
Yeah. I think the rudiments of it are there during, I'll do this presidentially, during the Obama administration. I think Trump heightened it. And I don't mean that he practiced identity politics. And I'll be fairly controversial. And I don't know whether your listeners are pro or anti-Trump or somewhere in between. I try to view him really independent of my own political judgment. He's a very interesting phenomena. Identity politics requires that you have a certain set of postures toward the innocent victim. And so guilt has got to be the central category within which you operate. And this is one of my larger arguments, is that we've got Christian guilt, very evident today, but no Christian solution to it. And I think part of the reason why Trump was such an incendiary figure is that he is absolutely unmoved by guilt. And so the meta narrative that we were told and we've absorbed is that everyone should be completely absorbed by guilt. And along comes this man who isn't, who literally can't exist in this moral universe, which is why I think the Russia collusion thing emerged. It's really an attempt to say that this man can't exist. There must have been some outside force which brought him into being. Anyway, I don't want to talk extensively about Trump, but I think there's this phenomena of the scapegoat is central to my analysis of where we are in America. Just very briefly, I'm center of the road, really, politically. I'm a registered independent. My view is there's this thing called the liberal order where in which we can all thrive through our mediating institutions. In those mediating institutions, we develop competencies and that we build a world together through those competencies. That has been interrupted by identity politics, which does not much concern itself with competence, but it does concern itself singularly with whether you fit an innocence category, whether you're an innocent victim. And so only the innocent victims can speak. Everybody else has to be purged. This is deeply pernicious. It's a variation of a religious movement. It is, as I call it, an American awakening, this time without God and without forgiveness.
That was the line I was just going to read to you to have you unpack for us and elaborate on. It's a very unique kind of religious movement. And you compare it to another politico dash religious movement, if I might say that about the French Revolution in your piece. Could you talk about those similarities?
Again, I think there's a great deal of conceptual confusion. I am a Tocqueville scholar first and foremost, and a great insight Tocqueville had later on in his life, maybe 20 years after he wrote Democracy in America, was that the French Revolution was an incomplete religion. And my argument is, the French Revolution was not the only incomplete religion we had. In fact, Marxism was the second great incomplete religion, which used the Christian category of the end times, but transposed it into a theory of history according to which we would have the revolution and communism would be the end time, where the lion would lay down with the lamb and scarcity would be overcome. And so many of my colleagues today say, well, what we're witnessing is just more cultural Marxism. And my answer is no, that's actually, it's quite different this time around. This is the third great incomplete religion that has emerged in the modern period in its identity politics. And what distinguishes it is that the central category is the scapegoat. That was not the category with Marxism. And for your readers or for your listeners who know much about this, Christianity claims that there's one sufficient scapegoat who takes away the sins of the world. That's Christ. Now, what happened with identity politics is that we've moved from this vertical relationship between all human beings who are broken sinners, who stand in need of redemption, to a horizontal relationship where certain groups are stained and impure and have to be scapegoated. And if we can simply remove those groups, then the purity of the world will be restored. And I'll say in advance, I'm disgusted by any sort of racial politics. But the general supposition of identity politics today is if we can purge, let's call it whiteness, and all that it has wrought. And that would include things like the nation state, the family structure as we understand it, capitalism, dirty fossil fuels, I'm sure the family, the so-called homophobic church, if we can just purge all those things that whiteness, white Europeanness has brought, then everything's going to be fine. Now, the point I would immediately make is that the problem with this framework is that once you purge one particular group, you're going to need another one. Already rudiments or evidence of the next group, and I do think it's women. I mean, one could look at the transgender movement as, in a way, canceling the category of women as we have understood it. But I think even quite independent of the transgender movement, I think there's evidence, the Karen meme, for example. But then most perversely of all, I think the next group after that are Black heterosexual males who believe in the family and believe in the church, as Martin Luther King did. So I hope you see the real moral agony of this. The argument is often made that civil rights goes to women's rights, goes to gay and lesbian rights, now goes to transgender rights. But if you get to the point where you're making the claim that in order to defend the transgendered, we have to problematize the idea that men are men and women are women, well, then you're going to start trampling on the 80% of Black Americans who strongly believe these things, who are, I think, uncontroversially still the most fragile subpopulation within the American regime. And I think this is a terrible, terrible move to make. It cannot be the case that people like Martin Luther King, who believed in the church and believed in the family, now have to be purged if we're going to settle scores and understand that the most important category before us are the transgender. This, I think, is a real problem.
And that's the sort of move that reveals that we're dealing with a religious movement here rather than a political movement, because it doesn't make any sense politically.
It doesn't make any sense politically. The thing is, what you have to do when you're looking, when you refuse the idea that Christ is the only innocent victim, this is what we have to be clear about in Christianity. Christ is the only innocent victim. All the rest of us are broken sinners. But when you move that to a horizontal relationship and you start looking for groups who are innocent victims, I mean, eventually you just have to keep going farther and farther out. So it was women in the 1970s, gay and lesbians 1980s, 1990s, transgendered now, and this must extend. And I want to be clear, I'm a liberal pluralist, and what that means is if there are groups of people who have heretofore been invisible, then by all means, let them join in. They're part of our republic. And so this is in no way being critical of the visibility of those groups. But the problem is the visibility of those groups is purchased at the cost of being critical and ultimately purging other groups who believe such things as men are men, women are women, and the church is something we need. I think that's a real problem. Let me make a distinction here. The liberal pluralist would say that there's a rule and then there are exceptions to the rule. And I want to live in that society. My view is that the world, our society is one in which we should absolutely privilege the generative relationship between men and women. But we've always had outliers to this. And I think the mark of a liberal society is its tolerance of that. However, on the left, it's not that the exception, that there are rules and exceptions to the rule. It's that the exception becomes the rule. And when the exception becomes the rule, then anyone who's not the exception or who doesn't want to abide by the exception becomes guilty of a thought crime. That's the moment in which we're now living.
You point out that after Christianity, I'll just quote you here, after Christianity does not come secularism. After Christianity comes the return of the group scapegoating characteristic of pagan man, which makes liberal politics impossible. This is just what you were talking about. This sort of secularism, in a way, is the fruit of Christianity or a part of sort of a Christian, at least a Christian social order, if not all Christian social orders. Is that the way to put it?
Yeah, it's a highly controversial claim. But look, I've spent a lot of my life, maybe a quarter of my life, in the Middle East. And group scapegoating is very common there. You don't have pluralism in the Middle East, but you do have it, or you have remnants of it in America. And the great question is why in the Anglo-American world did you have pluralism in the first place? And my argument is the only reason it happened was this Christian formula emerged, according to which you can't look at another person and believe that they're the answer to your problem of stain. your problem of stain runs so deep that only a divine scapegoat can take away the sins of the world, which is exactly what is said in the four Gospels. So I think this liberal pluralism is made possible because we realize that group scapegoating isn't going to solve our problem. And so group pluralism is only possible, I think, when you have this larger architecture of Christianity in place. But when it starts to dissipate, as it does or as it has, you don't get a secular republic free of religion. What you get is the reemergence of the ancient formula of scapegoating, which is that every group has to watch out for itself. Every group has to scapegoat other people. This is what happens in the Middle East. So the disappearance of Christianity doesn't give us peace. It returns us to very dark pagan understandings of how you get rid of the problem of impurity.
So if pluralism is a sort of legitimate expression of Christianity in the social order, it's the fruit of it rests on a Christian foundation. Does it worry you? I feel like I hear now more that abstract critiques of liberalism, as you well know, sort of have been bubbling up now for 30 or so years by some of the people that we know very well and respect. That seems, though, to be sort of taking the form in a more popular discourse on the right, and I'm talking now fairly far right, of sort of a suspicion of pluralism in general, that pluralism itself is sort of selling out. It's too unstable ever to work, and therefore let us grab the reins of power, have a lot of power, centralize one spot, and then fight for wielding it. I'm concerned about this growth of thinking on the right, but I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, so this is actually a big concern of mine, a growing concern of mine. I just came, I wrote this preface to the second edition of American Awakening, and I spent a lot of time in that preface addressing this exact issue. I think in the first edition, what I said was conservatives have no idea what this is. Another way of putting this was they were arguing that it's cultural Marxism and they didn't have a response to it. So I challenged the right and I said, there's a kind of impotence that you have with respect to identity politics. That was in the original preface. In the second preface, my argument is that in fact, the right is beginning to respond, and I think in deeply troubling ways. I think so many critics on the right now are saying that liberalism is a wholly secular thing. That it, in fact, issues in various pathologies like multiculturalism and finally identity politics. And therefore, the project before them it moves in two different directions. On the one hand, it moves to a kind of pre-modern anti-liberalism. And this has been identified in part by the term integralism. Sometimes it's political Catholicism. And then the other group is going to a kind of post-liberalism, and this is the Nietzschean alt-right. And I want to be clear that the Nietzschean alt-right is not Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer is tame compared to what the real alt-right is. Nietzsche, for your viewers or listeners, wrote in the 1880s, 1870s, very powerful figure, maybe the birth of postmodernism can be attributed to him. And we have to be clear, where Richard Spencer is saying, no, we're the innocent ones, those other people are guilty. What Nietzsche wanted to do was to get rid of the very categories of innocence and guilt altogether, which he saw rightly as being Christian and Jewish categories. And so if you're operating under the pretense of the Nietzschean alt-right, what you're saying is, well, yes, there was slavery in America, but we don't care. We don't feel guilty about it. There was the Holocaust in Europe. We don't care about it. There was colonialism in the Third World based in Europe. We don't care about it. And what I'm struggling to do is to retain the category of guilt. I think the category of guilt leads to deep reflection. It prompts us to ask the question, how am I implicated in what has happened? This deepened Western man. And this is exactly Nietzsche's argument, too. He saw that it did it, but he said, now that time is over and we have to move beyond it. I don't believe we've moved beyond it. I believe we must retain this category of guilt. But if it's shorn from its Christian framework, then you get Christian guilt and a never ending increase in the weight on your shoulders of that guilt. And as I say in the book, this was really the catastrophe of the late 20th century, the mid and late 20th century, precisely when the legacy of slavery comes to view in America, precisely when the legacy of colonialism comes to view in Europe in the post-war period. The Holocaust, you have all these profoundly violent events which can only be resolved through repentance, forgiveness, and atonement. But suddenly, all of a sudden, you don't have the Christian framework that allows you to lift the burden. And what the left does through identity politics is say, you have this guilt. I'm going to point out just how much you have. You think you understand it, but no, you're actually way more guilty than you know. And instead of inviting you to atonement and forgiveness, what it does is it says, come unto me, all you who are weary. Understand the Christian or the gospel reference. Come unto me, all of you who are weary, and I will give you rest. What you must do is renounce your nation, renounce your histories, renounce your heteronormative family, renounce your homophobic church, and I will give you rest. And I think hundreds of millions of people across Europe and the Anglo-American world are embracing precisely that bargain.
Well, we'll go to a break now. We'll come back and keep talking with Joshua Mitchell, author of American Awakening, about mediating institutions and citizen competence. We'll get to that right after this. Hey there, listener. I want to invite you to our 2024 Givers, Doers, and Thinkers Conference in sunny Malibu, California. This is our fourth annual conference, and it's called K to Campus, How the Education Reform Movement Can Reshape Higher Ed. The conference is a great opportunity to gather with donors, nonprofit leaders, and scholars, many of them you will recognize as guests on this podcast, to discuss some of the most pressing issues in the realm of education. Our featured speakers and expert panelists will address K through 12 school choice, the importance of donor intent when making gifts to colleges and universities, and many other topics. As some of you may know, we just wrapped up our sold-out 2023 conference in Scottsdale on the rise of the nuns. If you missed it but wanted to join, we are now offering special early bird registration to our podcast listeners for the 2024 conference. For a limited time, use code EARLYBIRD to register and receive a 50% discount. That's pretty good. A special link will be listed in the podcast notes. For information about conference sponsorships, including table sponsorships for your organization, please contact Center for Civil Society Director John Hanna at jhanna@centerforcivilsociety.org. We hope to see you in Malibu. We are back and very pleased to have as our guest, Dr. Joshua Mitchell, author of American Awakening, Identity Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. Also the author of a recent article in the August-September 2022 issue of First Things called By the Sweat of Our Brow. And that's sort of structuring our discussion. I want to get to this question about competences and mediating institutions. Before we do that, however, there's one little dangling thread I want to go back to, Josh, which just about this question of guilt and Trump. I think what you illuminated for me and what you were just saying was what makes Trump such an ambiguous figure or a Rorschach test is this question of his relationship to guilt. Is he a figure of the Nietzschean alt-right who is beyond guilt and therefore sort of beyond trying, you know, someone who might take us beyond the Christian dispensation in truly worrisome ways? Or is he someone who releases us from unjustly imputed guilt and therefore rebalances things? Am I kind of on the right path there?
Yeah. I mean, I think there will be people who will argue that he's a kind of Nietzsche. And I don't see him that way. He was raised in a Presbyterian church in New York City. I can't remember the name of the author right now, or the very famous book it's The Power of Positive Thinking.
Norman Vincent Peale. Yeah.
So he was in Norman Vincent Peale's church. And what Norman Vincent Peale was all about, it was Presbyterian church, and not by accident. I'll explain in a second. He was very much about releasing man's potential. Now, if you know anything about Calvinism, to say Presbyterianism, you know that there's a category in Calvinism called sanctification, where you're beyond the never-ending attempt to to establish your justification, that is to say, your guilt before God, and that Christ has saved you. And now you're at a new stage where you have a kind of clarity, and now you have to activate your call. So Trump will say, guilt is for losers. I mean, in one sense, it's a horrible saying, but it's something a Calvinist could say to a Lutheran, strangely enough. Because if you're really sanctified, you see things clearly. So I still think he's working within basically a biblical orb. I mean, look, I'm not going to defend this man's character. I'm going to say he's come along at a peculiar time in America where he is the flashpoint for identity politics. And I think he's become so popular. I don't know what his views are, but he's become popular because so many Americans see that he's the scapegoat. And Americans, I think, generally believe that we have a liberal order and we ought to have equality under the law. And yet here's this man who now, by virtue of the Mar-a-Lago, call it what you want, break-in, raid, legitimate confiscation, I don't know, he is now on a hero's arc. I mean, he's now even bigger than life. And I am firmly convinced that if he wants it, he will not only take the nomination, but be the 2024 president. Because Americans see that he is being scapegoated. And a lot of Americans feel like they're being scapegoated by an elite class that has all sorts of privilege and plays this game with the rest of us by which they distinguish their purity from our filth. And I think this began, I think, in fairness with Hillary Clinton's observation about the irredeemables and the deplorables. And again, we're in the midst then really of a religious war about impurity. And I think a lot of Americans are saying, look, I really don't want to be judged on the basis of some moral category of impurity that I really have no interest in. I just want to become a competent citizen. I want to live in my neighborhood. I want to be a good father and a good mother. And so they're just disgusted by this whole thing. And they see Trump being scapegoated by the new elect. And this is really the way we have to see this. It's the new elect who now run the world and know what is best for us. And I think Americans, frankly, have had enough of it again.
Well, that's a good segue. You mentioned competent citizens to what I wanted to ask you about next. You introduced a sort of periodization in your article. I'll read this. America enters the third stage of its history now. So the first, the founding period, based on citizen competence. The second, the progressive era, based on expert competence. The third, based on the politics of innocence and transgression. I wrote in the margins of my copy here, Josh, ideological competence, one might call this, if you wanted to keep the parallelism going. Could you talk about those periods and those particular kinds of competence and what their import is?
So here again, I think it's time that we become very precise with our language. So one of the arguments the conservatives make is that as I said before, we're dealing with cultural Marxism. Another argument they make is, boy, these progressives, they've really gone crazy. And my argument is, as I said earlier, it's not cultural Marxism, it's identity politics. And then to the second point, it's not progressivism anymore. It's something new. Our elite institutions used to produce expert competence to help run the government. This is the progressive era. And just to back up and to remind the readers that we had a small government. The founders gave us a small government because they believed that citizens had this immense wellspring of competence that they learned in their mediating institutions. And if you have got citizen competence, you don't need a government to watch over your every step. That's how you can have a small government. So America began to be settled in the 1620s. The national government comes along in the 1780s. We didn't need a national government for a very, very long time because we had to practice self-governance. So the first phase of American history was small government. And then pick the 1880s, maybe. You have the beginning of this claim, oftentimes by elites on the East Coast, that society has become too complex, that citizen competence isn't up to the task, and we need now to turn to the second phase, which means we need to transform our understanding of the Constitution. Not to the original. We don't have an originalist reading. We have a living constitution reading. Everything gets changed around. Government grows because citizen competence diminishes. Quick footnote before I talk about the third phase. As government competence increases, as expert competence increases, then what happens is that citizens lose the venues to establish their own independent competence, they become more impotent, and then the government has to step in. So we've got a vicious cycle of cause and effect. So that brings us to this current moment, which I think is a different one. I think we've passed the progressive moment, because the purpose of a Georgetown education, or pick Harvard, Yale, Princeton, almost every place now, is not to produce citizens who are capable, or experts who are capable of running the government. It is producing citizens who are woke, who know exactly what the intersectional scores of everybody on the planet is. And so, you know, Anthony Blinken insists that we fly the pride flag on the Afghan embassy. The withdrawal is a catastrophe, but I don't think they're troubled by it, because their view is, well, you know, we've made a statement about gay pride to the world, and this is what the rest of the world has to abide by. The Keystone Pipeline, and we had energy independence. You know, I'm all for finding much better solutions to the energy crisis that we face than fossil fuels. But in the interim, we have to use it. But no, we're not going to make that compromise with reality. We're going to shut it down right away. It's just astounding to me that the Biden administration at every turn has been much more concerned with sending the right signals to its woke base than with actually solving real problems. It's just astounding. So I think that's part of the reason why the Democratic Party is in terrible shape, why it's not controversial to say that in 2022, I think they're probably going to get trounced. And I've been saying for a number of years, what Trump did to the Republican Party was to destroy its two pillars. One, Ronald Reagan free marketism, and two, Bush neoconservatives. Just destroyed them both. And so since 2016, the Republican Party has been behind the scenes, I think, reorganizing itself. We'll see where it goes, but at least there's serious conversations. The problem with the Democratic Party is that the moderates were drummed out in the 2010 election. There are very few moderates left. And while I don't particularly like Pelosi, Biden, and Schumer, they're the last of a generation who had some pragmatic understanding that you have to cut deals. The next ones that are coming along they're going for broke. Everything has to be transformed. And I don't think they understand that this is just a train wreck that's going to happen to the Democratic Party, because they've drummed out all the moderates, and the older moderates are too scared to speak up. So it's a big problem. So we've entered into this new politics of innocence and transgression, but that itself it's a lie lived against reality, because we literally have to have competence.
Right. You point that out. And one of the most interesting scenes in your piece is the little Oberlin College story that you have in here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Perhaps you can tell that story to illustrate what you mean. Like, we have to have competence.
Yeah. So at Oberlin, I guess it was last fall, there was a dormitory set up for transgender and questioning students, mostly women. And of course, Oberlin is somewhat chilly in the winter, so you have to have dormitories heated up. And so the radiators needed to be fixed. And so the workmen, right? Just plain old guys. They came in and fixed the radiators, and the students were just incensed that their safe space was invaded by these cisgender men. They should have done it during the summer. And this is very telling, because it suggests that there's power relations here that are deeply distorted and, I think, shameful. That somehow, you know, every single safe space in America is made by the 96% of the workers who are, you know, cisgender guys, white, black, Hispanic. And somehow this group on the left can pretend that they have this safe space that's not built by, you know, guys who don't agree with them. So there's a power relationship here that's very, very troubling. And, you know, I remind my students that every 96% of the workers who build the buildings, who pave the streets, who fix the sewers, I mean, if you want to purge maleness, you really want to be careful here, because all the services that are provided, or almost all of them, are by these guys that the woke people hate. And you mentioned at the outset that I'm having construction done at my house. I mean, these guys are just normal guys. They're black, white, Hispanic. They don't care about their skin or race. They just care about competence. And they're just scratching their heads at what I'm telling them about what I'm seeing at Georgetown and Washington. They just can't believe it. They just want to be good plumbers, good carpenters, good drywall tapers. That's all they care about.
I suppose this makes them part of the problem from the perspective of the politics of innocence and transgression. And is that why that politics, the proponents of that politics, are, as you put it in the piece, so interested in liberating us from mediating institutions by destroying those institutions?
Yeah. So let me back up a little bit here. So Tocqueville's general theory, Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, everybody should own the book in hardcover. It's that important. So his general theory is that as you move from what he called the aristocratic age to the democratic age, you're going to have a problem. In the aristocratic age, you had the king, the nobles, and then the many, the one, the few, and the many. And as you move into the democratic age, that middle group gets destroyed, landed property folks get destroyed. You need to have something that stands in the middle between the individual and the state. And his argument was you need to have these mediating institutions. You need your families. You need your churches. And we can talk about what you learn in those things if you want, those institutions. You need your civic associations. You need your friendships. You need ways of being pulled out of yourself that the state doesn't cause you to do. So you absolutely must have those things in order to survive. Now, those mediating institutions have been withering for a very long time, starting really in the 19, right after World War II. You had Robert Nisbet and other social theorists seeing that we have a real problem here. We all know that as decade succeeds decade, these things are getting weaker. Now, okay, we need to rebuild them, but here's the problem. Identity politics is looking for stain everywhere. And so it finds in the family stain. It finds in the churches stain. It finds in our history and our monuments stain. And so it basically is coming after all the mediating institutions that we need in order to survive as a democratic republic. And that's what makes it so pernicious. It really does want to destroy the conventional family. It really does want to destroy the churches. I think Christians are beginning to awaken to this. And I'm not countenancing paranoia or anything, but it's a very hostile place for Christians these days, the country is. People who simply want to say, look, I'm a father, I have a wife, my wife and I love our children, we really don't want them to be exposed to drag queen story hour or transgender books, or more insidious still, health professionals who are coming into my schools and telling our kids that maybe they are transgender and we're going to give you hormone replacement therapy without telling us as parents. I mean, this is what's actually happening, Jeremy. So I think we're at an astounding moment in America. This is, I think, our darkest hour. What we're doing to our children, or what some people are doing to our children, is, I think, shameful and will have to be answered before the courts of law at some point and before God. It's that bad. So I don't think people understand this. We really are going to have to fight now for conventional family, the conventional churches. And as I said, I am a liberal. I'm fully prepared to live with the range of folks who don't believe what I believe. But it cannot be the case that this new idea that the exception is the rule comes to prevail, because that will mean the destruction of the conventional family, the destruction of the church. And Tocqueville was very clear on this. You destroy the family and the church and it's over. And Martin Luther King was very clear on this too. He wanted the state to supplement mediating institutions. But King and other Black leaders understood and to this day understand that the families and the churches are the key to Black America. You can't go in and destroy them.
Yeah, there were, and I suppose are, moderate progressives, you might say, or advocates of expert competence who did not want to completely eradicate the institutions that gave us citizen competence or the very concept of citizen competence. There don't seem to be many moderately woke people or moderate believers in the politics of innocence and transgression. That seems to be a contradiction, and that was what makes it so troubling.
Well, here's an interesting demographic. It's actually men and women my age, so mid late 60s. So I grew up in the 60s, and I was on the left, and I know how folks on the left think. And there's still a lot of people my age who believe the same things they did in the 1960s, and they think that what's happening now in the Democratic Party is contiguous with what they were arguing. And I keep telling them, no, you really need to open up your eyes here. You really do need to open up your eyes. And Martin Luther King argued that Black America wanted to go to the University of Alabama so that they too could read Shakespeare. That's not the argument being made today. The argument being made today is that Shakespeare is part of the white world, and it has to be purged. That's a very different kind of argument. And so the group that in the Democratic Party could have the authority to say, no, we have to stop. This is not what we had in mind in the 1960s. They're either too frightened or they don't see. My own view is that the one group of Americans who can stop this dead in its tracks are Black Americans. I tell Bob Woodson, who I work with very closely in the Woodson Center, I tell him that Black America has more moral authority at this moment in America than it did during the Civil Rights Movement. And he's not quite sure what to make of it, but I say, Bob, look, the only Black America can say to the feminists, to the gays and the lesbians, to the transgender, listen, if you have issues you want to raise, that's great, but you can't rest your moral claim on our suffering, because that has been the argument. As civil rights goes, so goes women's rights, gay and lesbian rights, and transgender rights. And my sense of this is that the Democratic Party requires Black America to adhere. And this, to me, is a very twisted dance that is done between the Democratic Party leaders and Black America. The Democratic Party will scream racism, 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 say we have your back, which is what they do for every election cycle. They illuminate particular instances which they say stand for the whole of American racism, systemic racism. And then after the election, a vast swath of Black America is thrown back into receivership in inner cities and in rural areas. They're not cared for. And Black Americans are expected to support every woke cause. So Black America is, in a way, used by, well, not in a way, it is being used by the Democratic Party to advance other social justice causes on the back of Black Americans. But when you get to the transgender one, as I've said several times, you're now going to destroy the very institutions that fragile Black Americans need in order to enter into the middle class, which should be the goal of every American citizen. We build a middle class commercial republic. We want a stable middle class, and we want those who are not yet in it to be able to join it. And in order to do that, you have to have a whole set of social skills, be able to take advantage of opportunities, almost all of which are produced in the family, in the churches, in safe neighborhoods. So if you don't have that, then you're not going to have anything but a permanent underclass of Americans, both Black and white, whose mediating institutions have been destroyed by wokeness, and they become permanent wards of the state. I don't think that's the kind of republic we intend to produce.
You actually end the article with this. You've brought us to a good point at a good time. It's a really good formulation that I'd like people to hear. Our mediating institutions are most needed by the least among us. And by making our lives larger, they make the need for government smaller. That, among other reasons, is why they must be defended. You really hit that note. You say only citizen competence, only the return of citizen competence can save us now. And that competence is built within mediating institutions. And they're really needed most for the least among us. Is there any practical step you would recommend to people who are fired up after hearing this podcast, they believe you're on the right track, to restore or strengthen mediating institutions and citizen competence?
Well, let me take a slice of that. The first thing we have to do is we have to get rid of collective guilt. This is profoundly pernicious. God did not put us on this earth simply to feel guilty. Now, there are wounds, and here I think I do depart from some of my conservative friends on the right who want to say, well, look, we live in a colorblind society, everything's fine. No, things are not fine. Things are getting better. I've seen this in my lifetime, and my guess is in two or three more lifetimes, things will be much better still. But there's an aching wound here. And it's not just in Black America, but it is in Black America too. And so the way Bob suggests we proceed, and I strongly endorse this for all of your listeners, is stop thinking about your guilt. Go out, look around your community, find members of the least of these who have become points of orientation within their communities. I think Bob Woodson is right. The problems of our communities are to find their solutions in the community. So pay attention. If you look around, you'll find that there are pillars in both Black and white communities who are doing yeoman service, and with a little bit of extra help, financially or otherwise, bookkeeping or something, baseball jerseys for the little league teams, you can make a profound difference. So stop looking at America as a whole. Go look at your neighborhoods. Ask around who's doing good work. Don't wear it on your sleeve. Don't tell anyone you're doing it. Empower those people who are working miracles right now. Bob says we don't need critical race theory. We need radical grace theory. People who've been transformed by grace and help them. And that's all we can do. And I think we have to understand, and I'll speak as a Christian here, you know, there's a mystery of suffering that we're not going to understand or solve. This doesn't mean we give up. It means that we're faithful. We do the small parts that we can to help people. There's always going to be suffering. We're called to be faithful amidst that. God will resolve the problem of suffering at the end of time. But in the meantime, I think charity and gratitude and grace and generosity are probably the best we can do.
Yeah, you know, the charity is not, and philanthropy are not a substitute for market commerce, but they are necessary supplements to market commerce. And I think that's really well put. Josh Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Jeremy. It's been good to talk to you.
Josh is the author of American Awakening, Identity, Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. You can buy that anywhere you like to buy your books, except try not to buy it from Amazon. It's our usual PSA here on this podcast. Thank you, Josh. Take care.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you enjoyed it, we invite you to subscribe and or rate and review this discussion on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our podcasts. And have a guest you'd like to hear from? Send your request to our producer, Katie Janis, at kjanis@amphil.com. That's kjanus@amphil.com.